Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, Paul, I seem to only get sick on weekdays.
Why do I feel like I've heard this one before? Okay, tell me
more.
I
must have a weekend immune system.
Huh, I was expecting a cardiac pun, but all right.
Yeah, well, you know, time is of the essence, Paul.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Moron Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frankwato, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, maybe even the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
He's certainly a primary care physician. Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great because this is the first of two episodes that we're doing with Dr. Michelle Kittleson. This is on heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or as you like to call it, Paul, HFrEF.
Love it. Love it. More abbreviations.
All right, Paul. And before we tell them about our wonderful guests, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. Well, as a reminder, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And Matt, I'd be happy to tell you about our guests in our episode if you like.
Yeah, please do.
So we are joined once again by the amazing Dr. Kittleson, Dr. Michelle Kittleson of Kittleson Rules fame on Twitter and of cardiology fame elsewhere. Dr. Kittleson is a professor of medicine at Cedars-Sinai and the director of education in heart failure and transplantation. She graduated from Harvard College and Yale Medical School. She completed her residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital and cardiology fellowship at Johns Hopkins, where she also received a PhD in clinical investigation. Dr. Kittleson is part of the ACC AHA Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Guidelines and the Heart Failure Guidelines, the Board of Directors of the Heart Failure Society of America, former interim editor-in-chief of the Journal of Heart and Lung Transplantation, and the associate editor for the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. So she's done some things, Matt. Her essays and poems have appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, and Annals of Internal Medicine. Perhaps you've heard of them. Her book, Mastering the Art of Patient Care, is available from Springer Publishing. In this episode, we go through HFrEF specifically. So she talks about sort of her initial workup, determining the underlying etiology, how she approaches guideline-directed medical therapy, and some of the ways that we can be helping the patients in the office as we titrate medications and counsel them about what their prognosis looks like, and some of the ancillary therapies we may consider once we stray outside of our pillars.
And a reminder to the audience that this and most episodes are available for CME, for all health professionals, through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so already, sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, access to our Discord, the CashLack Vault, all sorts of cool stuff, patreon.com/curbsiders. Michelle, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us again. This is, I guess, your third time, and you're about to do your fourth time right after this for the HFpEF episode. But before we get into talking about HFrEF, can you please remind the audience, actually tell them, what is a current hobby or interest that you have? Maybe it's skateboarding. If they're watching on YouTube, they can see all the skateboards in the background.
Yes. No, I have a terrible sense of spatial awareness, so you won't get me anywhere near a skateboard. Cooking is the only other thing I'm good at besides cardiology. And I'll tell you a 30-second anecdote. So at the end of my CV, I tout my cooking prowess. I talk about my famous peanut butter cookies. And once a colleague was reviewing my CV and he challenged me, he said, "I don't think your peanut butter cookies are that good." He happened to live in Cleveland. The Heart Failure Society of America meeting was going to be in Cleveland in a few months. I said, "Meet me in the lobby. I'll have your cookies." I made them. I froze them. I packed them in Tupperware. I put them in my suitcase. TSA had no problem with it. And I was vindicated. He said they were the best peanut butter cookies he'd ever had.
Is the Heart Failure Society ever going to meet in Philadelphia? Because, Paul and I would love some cookies.
We could certainly set something up as long as you promise to give me a fair and honest assessment of how delicious they are.
I do. And peanut butter, one of my favorite foods. So yeah, I think I would have no problem doing that, honestly.
You got it.
I mean, this is breaking news because we had a brownie incident, I think, was it our very first episode, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah.
So the peanut butter cookies is news to me. So I mean, we'll talk afterwards about that.
Yep. Sounds good.
Well, Paul, we have a very ambitious schedule tonight, so I think we should just get into a case from Cashlack Memorial. And we should mention that the great Dr. Deb Gorth wrote this case. So please accredit any jokes in their audience, you know, please attribute them to her and her fantastic wit. All right.
Well, with that preamble, let's learn about Mr. Smith, who is a 62-year-old gentleman. No real previous medical history that we know about before he had a recent hospitalization where he was diagnosed with heart failure. So he's coming into our outpatient clinic for his first outpatient visit after he was discharged from an area hospital not affiliated with Cashlack Memorial Health. Upon review of the discharge material, we find that he presented with shortness of breath and lower extremity edema, so a nice classic story. An echo done at that time revealed a left ventricular ejection fraction of 25%, moderate to severe mitral regurgitation. During this hospitalization, he was treated with IV diuretics, started on lisinopril, and discharged on lisinopril 5 milligrams a near homeopathic dose, metoprolol tartrate 12.5 milligrams twice daily, and 40 milligrams of oral furosemide. In our office, he says he's feeling better since he was hospitalized, which that's good. Instead of sleeping in a recliner, he's now sleeping in his bed again, but he's still using two pillows to help with his breathing. He can walk up a flight of stairs without stopping, but he does get winded when he gets to the top, which is a difference from his baseline prior to his hospitalization. His legs still feel a little bit swollen, but better than they did weeks ago. On examination, his blood pressure is 134 over 82. His heart rate is 82 and regular. Respirations are unlabored. O2 sat is fine. His jugular venous pressure is elevated about 2 centimeters above the clavicle when he's sitting nearly upright, and he does have pitting edema to his knees. He's shaken by this hospitalization, so he'd like to get back on track with his health. And so we've got this patient who comes to us with his journey started, let's say, in terms of his new heart failure diagnosis. So feeling better, but clearly not optimized. So Michelle, where would you start with this patient as he presents in your office, just almost completely tabula rasa for you?
Perfect. So the first thing you have to do when someone presents with a newly diagnosed cardiomyopathy, the first question you have to ask is why? Why does he have a cardiomyopathy? Because if you can identify an underlying etiology, it may allow you to have disease-directed therapy to improve his heart function, symptoms, prognosis, and also gives him a sense of what are the treatable causes. So what do we think about when we think about newly diagnosed cardiomyopathy? You want to think about coronary artery disease first and foremost, especially if you have a 62-year-old gentleman, older man, coronary disease is going to be on your list. Whether you do a stress test or you do a coronary CT angiogram or you do an invasive angiogram, it's truly dealer's choice based on your pretest probability and what's easily accessible and available at your institution. The other things you're going to want to look at, low-hanging fruit, you want to think about, could there be a thyroid disease? Could there be some kind of diabetes contributing? Could this patient have HIV? Could they have hemochromatosis? So the low-hanging fruit, in addition to the classic history, physical, social history for illicit substances, three-generation family history for potential familial genetic contribution, is going to be those sorts of tests: thyroid functions, hemoglobin A1C, HIV, serum ferritin transferrin. And then you might do a more focused workup if your history and physical leads you in a certain direction. Is there anything suggestive of a rheumatologic condition? Is there a signal from the three-generation family history that you should do genetic testing? Are you concerned about amyloidosis? You guys have a great episode on that. What about substance use? Cocaine, methamphetamines predominantly can lead to a cardiomyopathy. Is it something a zebra like acromegaly? Could they have some form of infiltrative disease for which you'll get a cardiac MRI? So start with the common things and then use your history and physical to guide you for the less common things.
I think we could do that, Paul. As internists, we're pretty good at thinking through a differential diagnosis and ordering tests.
Oh, I was thinking about like an order set where I can just click off everything.
Yeah. you like the Lyme panel on every order set, yeah, right?
Well, it's part of the fatigue panel, which I'm a big fan of. So yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
You guys are violating a lot of Kittleson rules right now, and I'm going to try to just remember, don't check a test that won't change your management. Before you check a test, make sure you know what to do with a positive, negative, or indeterminate result, or you shouldn't be ordering it.
So for this patient that we presented to you, he has extra fluid, and this always gets suggested to me. How about we check the BNP, compare it to their prior BNP. If we diurese them, can we follow the BNP? Where are we at with that?
Okay, so let's talk about BNP, B-type natriuretic peptide, released from the ventricle in response to increased LV wall stress, so a marker of volume overload and congestion. Let's talk about what the guidelines tell us, which is based on what the evidence tells us. When is a BNP useful? It's useful to support or exclude a diagnosis of heart failure. So it's a great test for a patient showing up to the ER with no prior history and shortness of breath, and there's a concern of heart failure. A BNP can help in that setting. It's useful on a patient admitted to the hospital with decompensated heart failure to establish prognosis. Remarkably, in one study, if your BNP was over 5,000, 8.5% in-hospital mortality. That is useful to get a sense of the trajectory of hospitalization. However, when is it not useful? The evidence for treatment guidance based on serial BNP or NT-proBNP is insufficient. So you should not guide your diuresis based on serial assessment of BNP. You should guide it based on your physical exam. So in this patient, an elevated JVP, edema, symptoms of orthopnea, though improved, and dyspnea on exertion, this is a slam dunk. This patient is congested, and they should be diuresed, titrated to their symptoms and their physical exam, not to their BNP level. It's so important to remember that the laboratory evaluation must be interpreted in the context of the clinical presentation. So use your BNP, but don't hang every management decision on it.
Yeah, and how much stock do you put in, you know, how it's affected by age and obesity?
Totally. There's, you know, obesity will lower your BNP. Age will increase your BNP. Kidney dysfunction will increase your BNP. So we have a lot of factors here. And then you do the thought experiment. If I have a patient who has dyspnea on exertion, orthopnea, elevated JVP, and edema, and their BNP is low, am I going to say, oh, you're not wet because they happen to be obese or they happen to have heart failure with preserved ejection fraction where it can be low? I'm not going to not diurese them. Let's take the other patient. They feel great. They walk 30 minutes a day. They sleep flat. Their JVP is normal. They have no edema. Their BNP is high. Am I going to empirically diurese them? No. So you have to remember, exactly as you know, there are pitfalls to the BNP where it can be falsely low or chronically high, and it can't do the day-to-day serial assessment of diuretics and volume status.
I've seen that latter example all the time, and especially for a patient with health anxiety who otherwise feels great, a BNP is checked, they're optimized, it's elevated. They're like, now what, is my heart bad? I'm like, I'm not sure what to do with this information. Like, I'm sorry. you look good. I guess we can check it again and see if it does something, but even that is sort of deeply unsatisfying. So that's very
helpful. No, I basically tell them the only thing we should do is go back in time and not have checked it. And short of that, we should never check it again.
Yeah. I mean, you get a lot of patients, especially when you're working in the hospital setting and they're admitted and they say, oh, their BNP is 10,000 this time. Last time it was 5,000. Does that mean it's worse? You know, you told us, if it's above 5,000, it's a bad prognosis, right? That's just like the fact that they've had a BNP that high.
That's right. But you're not going to say, oh, it's falling, which means I'm diuresing them appropriately, or it's rising, so I'm not diuresing them appropriately. That serial assessment is completely unhelpful. And we're trying to change hearts and minds here, no pun intended, not checking serial assessment of BNP.
Strong.
It is not beneficial.
Okay. Paul, do you ever struggle with the order of medications here?
It's so funny you mentioned that, Matt. Yeah, we were talking a little bit before we started, Michelle. I think one of the circumstances I will see is that a patient presents just like this. They are started on their treatment journey, as we talk about. They feel much better, but not well yet. And not sort of all the guideline-directed therapies are on board. And sometimes it's even hard to tell why that might be the case, whether it's insurance barriers or an electrolyte abnormality or what have you. So I guess for you, I think I've even asked you this before, if you had sort of a rank order preference as to what we should be starting and when, like, how do you think about that broadly? And then maybe we can use that to transition into sort of the pillars of therapy.
Perfect. So, well, I guess I sort of have to start with the pillars of therapy, right? Because the four pillars of guideline-directed medical therapy for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction are the angiotensin receptor neprilysin inhibitor, sacubitril valsartan, which is superior to an ACE inhibitor, which is in turn superior to an ARB. That's the first pillar. The second pillar is the evidence-based beta blocker, the soprolol, carvedilol, or sustained-release metoprolol. The third pillar is the mineralocorticoid antagonist, the eplerenone or spironolactone. And the fourth pillar is the SGLT2 inhibitor, empagliflozin or dapagliflozin. So within those classes, there's a class effect, they're all fine, but the ARNI is better than the ACE inhibitor, is better than the ARB for the first pillar. So what order do you do them? There's a lot of schools of thought on this. There are some people out there who say simultaneous initiation, just go for it and start all four at once. To those people, I say, I don't know if you actually take care of patients, because every time you give a medicine to a patient, it's like you're entering into a contract of trust, right? Take this mysterious pill and it will make you feel better and it will not make you feel worse. And they trust you. And if you give them four at once and they do feel worse and no one knows which one caused it, that's a violation of trust. So I'm all about rapid sequence initiation. Then you have to ask yourself, what order when it comes to rapid sequence initiation? And I'll tell you, there's one point to keep in mind. Remember which medicines actually help you feel better acutely and which medicines do not. They all help you live longer. They all help keep you out of the hospital. But which ones help you feel better acutely and which don't? Well, the one that does not help you feel better is the beta blocker. In fact, patients might feel a little worse after you start it. So you want to hold off on that until they're optimized on the others. So I typically start with the ARNI, followed by the MRA, followed by the SGLT2 inhibitor. And when I'm confident they are beautifully optimized, decongested, then I'll slip in the beta blocker. Now you might say to me, well, I prefer to start with the SGLT2 inhibitor, followed by the MRA, followed by the ARNI. And I'd say, fine. That the order of those three, hard to parse out which is best. But then if you said to me, they only have a certain amount of blood pressure to spend, what am I going to spend my blood pressure on? I can't spend it on the ARNI plus the MRA plus the SGLT2. Which one of those should it be? Well, then I'd say to you, the MRA and the SGLT2 inhibitor really don't bottom out blood pressure that much. So try to get that ARNI on first, since it's the foundational therapy, really the therapy upon which all other studies were performed. And then you slip in the other ones after that. So that's my philosophy. Think of what will cause acute hemodynamic benefit through their effects on vasodilation, ARNI, naturesis, diuresis, MRA, SGLT2 inhibitor. And then think about the beta blocker, which is good for long-term remodeling, but really can be poorly tolerated in someone who's decompensated.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. I've been using Freed for over 10 months now, and I have to say, I don't remember how I did my job in primary care without it. It just does such a great job of listening to the visits, writing the notes, and getting them ready so that I have barely anything left to do at the end of a visit. I'm out of my clinic so much earlier, I'm not doing pajama rounds. Let's face it, charting, it's critical, it's necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients. It eats away with your time, with your family, keeps you up at night. It's just such a burden that's always there. And Freed helps that go away because it does your soap notes for you. It learns your style over time, and just like a human scribe, it will never quit on you. Freed is already loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It's HIPAA compliant. It takes about 30 seconds to learn how to use it, and it costs only $99 a month, and your time is worth so much more than that. You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. That's freed.ai. Freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. This episode is brought to you by Litter Robot. There are a million reasons why you love your cat. The companionship, their affection, even their independence, and your security in the knowledge that you are probably one of the few humans they can actually tolerate and maybe even love. The worst part? Dealing with their litter boxes. Stop scooping poop and upgrade your litter box situation with Litter Robot by Whisker. Litter Robot by Whisker is a solution to all your litter box problems. Litter Robot's self-cleaning technology automatically cleans after every use, so your cats will always have a fresh bed of litter to do their business, and your friends won't think your house smells like a litter box. And get this, Litter Robot will send a notification to your phone when it needs to be emptied. It even gives you data and insights to stay on top of your cat's health. Join over 1 million happy pets and pet parents who have upgraded to Litter Robot. What are you waiting for? Now let me let you in on a little something. We get to try the products that we advertise on this show, and without a doubt, Paul Williams, Dr. Paul Williams, America's primary care physician, my co-host, has never gushed about another product like he has about Litter Robot. He is legitimately excited to talk about it whenever you bring it up. And right now, Whisker is offering $75 off Litter Robot bundles. And as a special offer to listeners, you can get an additional $50 off when you go to stopscooping.com/curb. That's an additional $50 off when you go to stopscooping.com/curb. stopscooping.com/curb.
Can I ask about the order of the Arnie Ace Arb, which I might be lightly surprised about. I think it's, at least in terms of treating hypertension, I always am much bigger Arb fan than I am an ACE inhibitor fan. And I would just think in terms of transitioning to an Arnie, if you have the Arb on board, that also might be a little bit easier potentially. So I guess, can you talk to me about the evidence making ACEs a little bit better in the circumstance? Because that's a little bit counterintuitive to me.
Yeah, me too, me too, me too. If I'm treating hypertension, I will always give an ARB or an ACE because I don't want someone to have some random angioedema 5 years from now, totally unpredictably, and show up in an ER and then everyone's upset. Totally. If it's hypertension, give the ARB over the ACE inhibitor. Now, if you look at the clinical trials, the foundational landmark trials in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, starting way back in 1987 with the consensus trial, captopril saved lives. And that's really where the journey of RAS inhibition began. Later on, they did studies comparing ARBs to ACEs. And you know what? ACE inhibitors won. So it's unequivocally true that ACE inhibitors are better than ARBs for this one indication and one indication only, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Then, of course, Paradigm HF 2014 knocked the ACE inhibitor off its throne, the Arnie 1, sacubitril valsartan, compared to enalapril in an active control head-to-head trial. So now it's clearly established Arnie is better than ACE inhibitors, better than ARB. So if I had the opportunity to have a fresh patient in front of me who's newly diagnosed, I just start the Arnie. Why not? They're there sitting in front of me. Why would I start with something else when I've got the best therapy at my disposal? Now you could say, well, but in the Paradigm trial, there was a run-in and, that was for trial purposes. Really, pathophysiologically, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Just start them straight on the Arnie. And I'll only go to an ACE inhibitor instead if it's a cost issue, or if it's a tolerance, it's like they're just too hypotensive to tolerate the dual vasodilation of the sacubitril valsartan. Plus, it's twice daily dosing, whereas I could just slip in 2.5 of lisinopril at bedtime and maybe avoid some of the hypotension. And I only reach for an ARB if they have angioedema to an ACE, because that would contraindicate the Arnie, because Arnies have high risk of angioedema, because the sacubitril leads to increased bradykinin the same way an ACE inhibitor does. So that's really the hierarchy. But I see no reason not to just start with the Arnie if that fresh patient is sitting in front of you.
With the Arnie, I find that the biggest barrier is cost. Maybe the second biggest barrier is hypotension. And that was the run-in, right? The run-in in the Paradigm HF trial was to weed out the patients that just couldn't tolerate from a blood pressure standpoint.
Yes. So let me tell you my philosophy. That first, the cost issue, let's all give thanks to the unsung heroes of medicine, our pharmacists. We are very lucky to have a pharmacist attached to our heart failure clinic who helps us with the arduous process of black box of making things affordable. Second point is I always am very open with patients. I say, I think this is the best medicine for you, but I know everything about cardiology and absolutely nothing about what the sticker price will be when you take this prescription to the pharmacy. So if it is too high, you should not mortgage your house to take this medication. You should let me know. There are other alternatives, which are maybe incrementally not as good, but certainly not worth mortgaging your house to afford this one.
Right.
Second, the hypotension issue. So this is, I'm going to say something controversial. Isn't that great? I tell my patients when I start them on GDMT in clinic, I say, I want you to go home and I don't want you to check your blood pressure. I don't want to know what it is until we have our 2-week follow-up appointment. And maybe it's over the phone that one time I want to see what your blood pressure is, or when you come back to clinic. The only reason I want you to check your blood pressure when you leave my office is if you feel poorly in some way. Because if you feel great, by definition, your blood pressure is great. So I don't care if it's 90 over 60. I don't care if it's 88 over 58 or it's 110 over 70. If you feel good and you can go about your day without almost fainting every time you stand up, then the number is not important to me. And I think that it also lets patients know they're not so focused on this number, and it allows more optimal and effective GDMT titration.
Yeah. You know, Paul, I don't know if you find this too. I mean, I'm still seeing the majority of patients with heart failure. They seem to be on ACE, ARB, beta blocker, and MRA because those are just like affordable. A lot of the Medicare patients, like their copay, they do have a portion of cost sharing, and it just seems like the SGLT2 ARNI combo is just like can really be a lot of money for people.
Yeah. It's always, yeah, it's sort of a tragically pleasant surprise when I see an ARNI in the wild, because I'm like, oh, good for them. Like, but it's not, yeah, I agree with you. That's not typically what I see.
And then you have to decide then. Say they only have a certain amount of money to spend. Are they going to spend it on the ARNI, or are they going to spend it on the SGLT2 inhibitor, right? That's maybe they only have enough money for one of them. Honestly, in that situation, I truly believe in the power, the synergistic power of the four pillars. And in that situation, put them on the generic lisinopril and let them spend whatever funds they have on the SGLT2 inhibitor.
That's great. Yeah, that's very, I think that's a very practical way to go. And then, you know, sometimes you just see patients for whatever reason, they're not on all four, and it can be kind of hard to sort out. But sometimes I think it's because maybe they didn't tolerate it, or they had hyperkalemia, hypotension, that sort of thing. So it sounds like you're just sort of getting as close as you can to the ideal situation based on cost and side effects and everything. Anything else to say on that?
Yeah, you know, for anyone who works in an electronic medical record system, just searching for the drug is often really helpful. Like, why aren't you on spironolactone? This makes no sense to me. Oh, now I can search and I see that note and it said you had a K of 6 3 times when someone tried. So I think that's really helpful. And then you can document. So you have to ask yourself, if a patient's not on the four pillars, why not? And if they are, can I titrate?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe we should just mention the strong heart failure trial. Right. So this was the one where they put patients, they were admitted with acute decompensated heart failure. Before they left the hospital, they started them on the four pillars. And then by 6 weeks, they were trying to get them up to goal. So maybe you can talk about what was goal, what are the goal doses? And you already mentioned, you know, you do the rapid sequence initiation. But what do you think about that trial?
I think that trial is really, really cool. And now, because of when the enrollment started, there was actually three pillars in the trial. SGLT2 inhibitors hadn't become standard of care at the time of enrollment. But ARNI, ACE, ARB, beta blocker, MRA, as you said, by the time of hospital discharge for admission for decompensated heart failure. And then with 2 weeks, the goal was to have them on 100% of recommended doses, and then they were followed for 6 months. So what are the max doses that we want? It's 97-103 for sacubitril valsartan, 200 for metoprolol succinate, and it's 25 for spironolactone, and then for the SGLT2 inhibitor, it's only one dose, 10 of dapagliflozin or empagliflozin. And what was so remarkable to me about this trial is when they looked 3 months later, much higher proportion of patients were on target doses if they were in this high intensity group as opposed to randomized to the usual care group. I mean, that's not necessarily so surprising. You try to get someone on meds, they get on meds. What was really amazing was when they looked at 6-month outcomes, death, heart failure, hospitalization, it was 15% in the high intensity group. It was 23% in the usual care group. That's an absolute risk reduction of 8% in 6 months. That's a huge effect size. That to me is such really important evidence to work hard with your patients and empower them to say, listen, if I get you on these pillars, you're not going to see an effect in 5 years. You're going to see a benefit within 6 months of being on these incredible therapies.
Yeah. I mean, that is incredible. It was exciting to hear that. And, you know, I feel like I am seeing more patients now, just anecdotally, that are being discharged like more aggressively on more medications when they're initially sent out of the hospital from a heart failure exacerbation. And that's also why close follow-up is necessary, because sometimes the patients they started me on like 6 things. I don't know what any of this is.
Yes.
And you kind of have to talk them through it.
Yeah. I mean, the hospitalization is it's a luxury, right? To check blood pressure and blood work every single day. It's a teachable moment. It's a great opportunity. But as you know, you got to close the loop on follow-up to reinforce the importance of meds, to check the heart, blood pressure, to check the laboratories. So that reinforcement is critical.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michelle, I've noticed a couple of times you said metoprolol succinate. I will take us back to our case where the patient was actually on metoprolol tartrate. I have learned anecdotally a great way to make cardiologists mad is to use metoprolol tartrate for HFrEF. So could you talk me through how we might optimize this? But why? Who cares? Why do we care? And then how would you optimize this patient's regimen?
Yeah, first, no, you don't make cardiologists mad. You just hurt our feelings, right? We're really sensitive and we just want what's best for the patients. We're not angry.
That's
not,
even better news.
What does a mom say? I'm not angry with you. I'm disappointed with you. Uh-huh. Yes, I'm very disappointed. Okay, so there's the landmark clinical trials of beta blockers with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction used bisoprolol, sustained release metoprolol, metoprolol succinate, and carvedilol. There actually was a small trial somewhere in the 90s using the tartrate, metoprolol tartrate, and patients didn't benefit. Now, you could say maybe the trial was too small or maybe they just didn't give it right. But for whatever reason, we have to be guided by the evidence we have. And there's only one class of medication for which there is a class effect, and that is the beta blockers. Bisoprolol, carvedilol, sustained release, metoprolol, metoprolol succinate. So I would immediately switch this patient to the metoprolol succinate. Which of those three do I use? For whatever reason, in my hospital system, bisoprolol isn't commonly used. It's usually a toss-up between carvedilol and sustained-release metoprolol. Do I have a preference? Yes. My preference is metoprolol succinate. Why? Because carvedilol is twice daily and it has alpha-blocking properties, so it's more likely to cause hypotension. So if I want to slip on a beta blocker, but I don't want to spend my blood pressure on a beta blocker, I want to spend it on my ARNI predominantly and then my MRA and SGLT2 inhibitor, then I'm going to want to give them the beta blocker that's least likely to lower their blood pressure. And in addition, a nice trick with a once a day medication is you can slip it in at bedtime. So even if the metoprolol might cause fatigue, if the peak effect is while they're sleeping, who cares anyway? So that's why I would immediately switch this guy to metoprolol succinate, quick fix, tell him to take it at bedtime, and he's already going to be on a better pillar.
Yeah. Am I hallucinating this, or is metoprolol succinate, the 25 milligram tab, it's one of the rare long acting tabs that can actually be split, right?
You can get
12.5.
Exactly. Exactly. And what dose you start on is kind of philosophical, right? I mean, I tend to just start with 25. Mm-hmm. And even like spironolactone, I just start with 25. I don't do the 12.5. I'm like, whatever's a little less work for me, because, you know, if you're going to get hyperkalemia, you're probably going to you're going to get it no matter what dose you give. So that's just sort of an efficiency thing on my standpoint. Mm-hmm. But yes, if I start the 25 and they don't tolerate it, first of all, it's a little concerning to me, because intolerance of guideline-directed medical therapy is a poor prognostic sign. But then absolutely, you can split it in half, which is a nice trick.
And then we're checking metabolic panels probably every 1 to 2 weeks, because hyperkalemia with, you know, with the MRA, the ARNI, ACE-ARB, and...
Yeah.
I feel like the SGLT2 is one of the easier ones to start generally. Joel Toff even told us he doesn't think you even need to really check anything, because you know the EGFR is going to temporarily go down a little bit, but don't even worry about that. So
yeah.
I'm not super aggressive. If they're just on that, I'm not usually checking. But for these patients, they seem to get labs at least every 2 weeks or so initially.
So during dose adjustments, usually about a week later, check it.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they're on stable doses, really every 3 months is standard, is for the ARNI, ACE-ARB, for the MRA. And I agree with Dr. Toff, you know, SGLT2, you almost don't want to know about that little bump, right? Just ignorance is bliss. Just if they're clinically doing well, just follow them.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask, so for our patient here who's a little bit congested still, but doing better, would you fire off the SGLT2 and leave the diuretic alone? Like, I guess this is my larger question. Like, how do you think about the diuretics that are already on board when you're starting the SGLT2s, or do you just not worry about it?
Yeah, you know, in the olden days, when we first started using the SGLT2 inhibitors, we'd say, oh no, it's going to cause a big diuretic effect. You better back off on your diuretic. It turns out it doesn't really do that. But that being said, it's always such a joy to add these pillars, the sacubitril valsartan, the MRA, and the SGLT2 will all have a diuretic effect. So they tend over time to need less loop diuretic or need less augmentation. And we know that loop diuretics in heart failure are a necessary evil, right? You got to take them so you're not congested and drowning in fluids, but they don't actually offer any benefit whatsoever to your patient, and maybe even potential detriment to your neurohormonal system. So if you can get these other agents on and it allows you to minimize loop diuretics, it's a huge win. So for this particular gentleman, I would probably, you know, he is still pretty symptomatic and his JVP is pretty high. He's got a lot of edema. So what I would probably do is add the SGLT2, also double his diuretic, but see him relatively quickly, 1 to 2 weeks, because at that point, he may have been magically better. And when I add the MRA, maybe go down on the loop diuretic.
So with the SGLT2s, you know, we talked about the EGFR kind of, you know, going down slightly. We know that's going to happen. But for this cutoff, you know, they've studied, it's, I think, empagliflozin has been studied at lower EGFRs and then dapagliflozin. I haven't really put too much thought into that. I'm kind of just using them almost regardless. Where are you at on that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the heart failure guidelines, they'll tell you EGFR 20 to 30. Mm-hmm. So to have heart failure with an EGFR less than 20, I mean, then the nephrologist is really in charge of everything, right? I mean, that's a hugely horrible kidney function. So what the lesson is exactly like you say, you're pretty much not going to find anyone who's not on dialysis, who can't tolerate the SGLT2 inhibitor. And exactly like you said, you don't want to obsess about that early bump in creatinine. So don't look at the blood work, look at the patient. If the patient looks okay, say, we're just going to figure out if this is an outlier or a trend, let's recheck your blood work in 2 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the other stuff that's been around, Paul, remember in residency, we were using a lot of hydralazine and isosorbide dinitrate because, you know, we didn't have all these other medications yet. And so I'm curious as to where we're at with that now.
Yes.
Dr. Kittleson.
I'm so glad you asked about hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate, because to me, this is a really good example of a term I think I coined, indication creep. Okay, so let's talk about hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate. It's vasodilators, right? So back in the 80s, all of the heart failure giants of the day knew that afterload reduction was good for patients with HFrEF, right? It stands to reason hemodynamically. You got this poor, weak, failing heart. You'd reduce their afterload. And now this poor, weak, failing heart has less resistance. It can pump better. The stroke volume increases. Everyone's happy. Well, there's a lot of different ways to decrease afterload. You could give an ACE inhibitor. You could give hydralazine isosorbide. You could give prazosin. And in fact, the VHEFT-1 trial, which came out in 1986, tested hydralazine isosorbide versus prazosin versus placebo. No surprise to anyone, prazosin didn't work, and no one ever thought about it again unless they had BPH. But the raging debate of the mid-80s was, which vasodilator is better? Is it isosorbide dinitrate hydralazine, or is it the ACE inhibitor? And then the VHEFT-2 trial came out, and it was 1991, and they pitted the two against each other, and isosorbide dinitrate hydralazine lost. So no one thought about it anymore. It was the loser. ACE inhibitors were the best until 2004, when the AHEFT trial came out, which took patients self-described as Black American with severely symptomatic HFrEF, class 3 to 4, and gave them isodyl hydralazine, and there was a reduction in mortality. So that's the soundbite. If you're African American and you have HFrEF, Hefref, you should be on isosorbide dinitrate hydralazine. That's the soundbite. That's the indication creep. You got to look at the fine print of that study. What does the fine print of that study tell us? It tells us that when that trial was published, 2004, what was the best therapy around at the time? ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. Well, 90% of patients in that trial were on an ACE inhibitor. 70% were on a beta blocker. And the baseline blood pressure at the start of the trial was 120 millimeters mercury. Can you think of a patient with severely symptomatic HFrEF who actually has a blood pressure that high? All of that to say that the AHEF trial was focused on a very specific population of patients already on the best GDMT that existed at the time, who still had blood pressure room and severe symptoms and showed a benefit. All of that to say that isosorbide dinitrate hydralazine is not a substitute for the four pillars of GDMT. It is an adjunctive therapy if your patient happens to have blood pressure room despite the four pillars of GDMT. And in observational studies of who actually meets those criteria, it's about a 1% of patients in cohorts. And in my clinical practice of, I don't even know how many hundreds of patients I follow, I have exactly one patient who has blood pressure room for this combination after I've optimized the four pillars. So think of it only in rare situations when you've already optimized GDMT.
Yes, that's such a good way to frame it. I think once in a while you still see patients with just on hydralazine randomly, and you know, you don't know what their blood pressure journey has been, but I'm still seeing more of it than I would like to, Paul. I would say it's like the gabapentin of blood pressure medications, in my opinion, Paul.
It's either a Hail Mary pass or someone gets grandfathered in. There's no in between. Like, I don't see like anyone who's been started on it recently unless you just run out of other options.
Yes. Okay. This episode is brought to you by Beginly Health, the job matching platform for every physician and advanced practice clinician. If you're tired of recruiters calling and texting you nonstop and wondering if that salary offer is really competitive, or maybe you just want to find the right job without fear of your personal information being leaked to the internet, well, Beginly Health gets it. You want control over your job search, your information, and ultimately your future, and you should. That's why Beginly created a new and better experience for job seekers that confidently matches you with jobs you're actually interested in, and recruiters and employers can't access your info until you decide to share it with them. Whether you value salary, living in a specific location, or working with an underserved population, Beginly's matching algorithm weeds out the noise and helps you find the perfect match. Their platform takes your personal, professional, and location preferences into account and then continuously works for you in the background to present jobs and employers that match what you're looking for. And it's completely free for you. Ready to take control of your job search? Visit beginlyhealth.com/curbsiders to get started. That's beginlyhealth.com/curbsiders. Beginly Health, powered by preference, connected by passion. Now, maybe we should make Paul pronounce these, but I'll take it. So
I'm just going to try.
Okay, Paul, what are the other two fancy ones that I've never prescribed, probably never will?
Well, let's split up, because I was going to ask about the ibabradine. Pause to see if anyone makes a face that I mispronounce it. Because that was what I remember when it came out. I remember the study, and there was like a lot of wild enthusiasm about it. And I think I've rarely seen it out in the wild. So I would love to know when you think about that and how you use that medication. Then, Matt, we can arm wrestle over who has to say the next one.
Cool. And I've spent much of my life mispronouncing things. I say ivabradine, but potato, potato, I'm cool. So it inhibits the funny current of the sinoatrial node, which means it reduces heart rate without reducing contractility. So technically, because we know patients who live at a higher heart rate with HFrEF do worse, if you can optimally lower their heart rate, that should do better. The SHIFT trial showed it reduced heart failure, hospitalizations, and death as a combined endpoint. But again, beware of indication creep. In that study, patients were already on max tolerated beta blocker because beta blockers save lives. And then, and only then, ivabradine was added. So there's a lot of caveats if you're going to give a patient ivabradine. They should be on max tolerated beta blocker. They should be in sinus rhythm because ivabradine can predispose to atrial fibrillation. And they should have a heart rate above 70 beats per minute, because that was the inflection point in observational studies at which point prognosis worsened in patients with HFrEF. So I agree with you. I don't use it that frequently either, because I find if I can really max out my metoprolol succinate to 200 milligrams QHS, heart rate isn't that high. And really the effect size in the clinical trial was not that impressive. So I would say I would relegate ivabradine really into the same drawer as hydralazine isosorbide dinitrate, maybe some benefit, but avoid indication creep.
And then the third one is verequiguat. That's definitely wrong. But this is an oral guanyl cyclase stimulator.
Yeah.
Wait, let me try. And then we'll take you to the tiebreaker. So I would have gone verasiguat.
Ooh, you know
that
what?
Sounds
you're
better.
You're a little closer. It's a verasiguat. Yes, that's what the experts say. So,
but
no one does it very often because no one prescribes it very much. So an oral guanylate cyclase stimulator, it's supposed to do all kinds of wonderful things to the endothelium, nitric oxide, this and that. So the Victoria trial was the landmark trial. It was a very large trial, like 5,000 patients. And they had to be kind of sick. They had to have symptoms or recent hospitalizations, recent IV diuretic use, randomized to verasiguat versus placebo, pretty good baseline GDMT in this population. And the effect size was really small. So at a follow-up of around 30 months, the point estimate of death and heart failure hospitalization was 29% in the placebo group, 27% in the treatment arm. High event rates, let's say that. I mean, this is a sick population, but verasiguat did not move the needle appreciably, which is why the guidelines give it a relatively weak class 2B indication based on the minimal magnitude of benefit. So here's how I think about verasiguat. Will I prescribe it in someone who I've attempted optimal GDMT, who is still being hospitalized for heart failure? Yes, I will use it in that population. But I think about verasiguat as the start of the conversation, not the end of the conversation. Meaning, you're really sick. Every time you're hospitalized for heart failure, you have a 30% chance of mortality within the next year. So you're already in a sick subset. I might be giving this to try to help, but I already know from the clinical trial, it's probably not going to help that much. And let's have a larger conversation about what are your other options at this point, given your poor prognosis.
So let's go back to our patient. He has an EF under 25%. So we're going to want that defibrillator, right? And then maybe you can comment on his mitral regurgitation as well.
Yes, I would love to. So he may or may not need a defibrillator, right? Because if he has ischemic cardiomyopathy and we revascularize him and give him GDMT, or if he has a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy and we optimize his GDMT and we check an echocardiogram 3 to 6 months later, he may have recovery of his ejection fraction. In observational cohorts, about 30% of patients can actually achieve this magical goal of heart failure with improved ejection fraction. Ejection fraction, it goes from below 40% to above 50%. I've seen it so many times with my own eyes. It never gets old. It is the best feeling in the world. So you're not going to jump on that defibrillator for primary prevention. You're going to first optimize their GDMT and maybe they won't need it at all. Ditto for cardiac resynchronization therapy, this magical therapy that allows the ventricle to beat more synchronously unlike defibrillators, which just may save your life if you have an event, CRT actually improves symptoms. Mm-hmm. But again, you would hold off unless they truly meet the criteria of that reduced ejection fraction along with the widened QRS after optimization of GDMT. And that same principle, see what happens after you optimize GDMT, applies to the mitral regurgitation. I'm fascinated by secondary mitral regurgitation. Okay, there's something about mitral regurgitation. Primary means it's the valve's fault. Secondary means it's the ventricle's fault because this poor, failing ventricle is super dilated. So the little leaflets can't coapt anymore, can't come together, and therefore leakiness ensues. Back in the olden days, they tried to do surgery. But you know, when you crack open the chest of someone with a low EF, things do not go well. Surgery did not work. And then all these amazing wizards of interventional cardiology, I'm convinced they played a ton of video games as a kid. They came up with these techniques where you could kind of basically play a video game inside the heart and clip the mitral valve together through a catheter-based approach. And in doing so, make the mitral regurgitation go away. So the question is, does it work or not? And this is such a beautiful lesson in randomized trials, because we think always in the hierarchy of evidence, that randomized controlled trials are the truth. They are the gold standard. But when it comes to secondary mitral regurgitation in patients with HFrEF, we have one trial that said it was amazing and one trial that said it didn't work. So what does that tell us? What's the lesson there? The lesson is, yes, randomized controlled trials tell you the truth, but only the truth about the population they enrolled. Mm-hmm. So MITRA-FR was a trial that showed no benefit. It took patients that had severe MR, not a lot of effort into optimizing therapy or attention to the LV size, et cetera. Then you have COACT, which is quite a highly curated trial. On entry, to be randomized to the mitral valve transcatheter edge-to-edge repair or standard therapy, they had to have an EF between 20 and 50%, an LV size less than 7 centimeters, pulmonary artery pressure less than 70, and they had to be optimized on guideline-directed medical therapy as signed off by a heart failure specialist. And that is the sweet spot. So what COAP did that MITRA-FR didn't is they got the patients who were not too sick, meaning the EF was too low, the pulmonary pressures were too high, the LV was too big, meaning the horse was out of the barn. And they also didn't enroll the patients that were too well, because, you know, if you just optimize GDMT, everything would get better and they wouldn't need this to begin with. So COAP took that sweet spot, which is why the guidelines are very clear on the criteria of who should be referred for this mitral valve transcatheter edge-to-edge repair, aka mitral valve tier, which is they have to already be optimized and still have severe MR, and their LV can't be too big, their EF can't be too low, and their pulmonary pressures can't be too high. And that's such an important lesson for our patients. And also, one of my pet peeves in life, because I have so many, is checking a knee-jerk echocardiogram on a patient admitted with decompensated heart failure who has a known cardiomyopathy for two reasons. Number one, if I already know their EF is 30%, is a repeat echo showing that it's 20, 25, 35, is that really going to change anything I do? No. Second, so sometimes I do like to debate with my trainees, and I say, so why'd you get the echo? And they currently know, they know me by now, and they might say, well, we want to see if the patient is a candidate for the mitral valve tier. And I say, wait a second, though. This patient is decompensated. Do I really care about the degree of mitral regurgitation in the throes of an acute decompensation? Cancel that echo. Let's order it prior to discharge when they're fully optimized. So that's a reason. I can't think of a good reason ever to check an echo to document anything on a patient who's highly decompensated.
Oh, that's a really good point. Because that's mostly when it gets checked, like right when they come in before you optimize them. And if you already know the EF is low, it doesn't, you don't need to. Speaking of the ejection fraction, the HFrEF, heart failure reduced ejection fraction, when we talked to Dr. Yancey, he taught us that heart failure with recovered ejection fraction was something that was being was noted at the time. But recently a resident told me, I thought this was a cool thing, a resident taught me that they change it to heart failure with improved ejection fraction, the term that you just used. And that's because we wanted people to remind people that it has improved, but it's not fully recovered. They still need to be on guideline-directed therapy. And that's the key point. Because sometimes if you look at an echo and it's their ES 50%, people forget that they need to be on these important medications.
You know, that's exactly right. Words matter. And that's why we call it heart failure with improved EF now. And I remember back in the olden days when I would have a patient and I'd put them on their GDMT and their EF would recover. And they'd say to me, can I stop these meds now? They're really annoying. And I'd say, I think so. Nobody really knows. And I know you're really young and you don't be on medications forever. Let's stop one and check an echo and stop another. And who knows what'll happen. And then the TREAD-HF trial came out. Such an important, beautiful trial. Listen, it was only 50 patients, but it got into the Lancet because it had great study design and a really important clinical question. So they took these patients who had heart failure with improved ejection fraction, who were on GDMT, and half of them, they said, stay on your GDMT. And half of them, they said, you can stop your GDMT. And then they said 6 months later, how do you look? They looked at LV size. They looked at EF. They looked at clinical heart failure. They looked at BNP. And what did they find? no one had any relapse based on those four parameters. If you continued GDMT, but 44% had some form of relapse if you stopped GDMT. So really, this is so important for us as clinicians, because it's hard to tell a young person who feels great, whose heart is normal, to stay on four medications. But now at least we have the backup of evidence to tell us, you know what, it's really in your best interest to do it.
So I do want to ask about some non-pharmacologic stuff, but Paul, you want to get back to the case and then we can ask any final questions for this?
Yeah, I don't expect you to know numbers, Michelle, but my sense of things is that resynchronization therapy is being offered less frequently because we've gotten so much better at managing with guideline-directed medical therapy. Is that a real trend or just sort of what I'm feeling in my heart? Because I feel like I just don't see it talked about as much because we're seeing the ejection fraction improve so much now that we have these great medications that can be helpful for things.
I can't roll off a trial off the top of my head, but I completely agree with you. And what's so fascinating about the cardiac resynchronization therapy too is, you know, there are 30% are non-responders. So you really want to pick the right patient. That QRS left bundle is so wide and the GDMT is totally perfect. And there are patients who you've optimized their GDMT, they feel amazing, but their EF is still low, and then you do the CRT, and lo and behold, their EF improves. So it is still an important part of our armamentarium, but you're exactly right. Push it off. Put the pills on first.
All right, perfect. Thank you. And along those lines, so we'll go back to our patient. Sorry, Matt. He's doing better. We started him on outpatient titration of his heart failure medications. He is now on maximally tolerated doses of guideline-directed medical therapy. He can now carry his groceries up a flight of stairs, the single most important question we've ever asked in any physical exam ever. he's thinking about walking in an upcoming 5K turkey trot. So we repeat his TTE now that we have him optimized, and his ejection fraction is now 45%. The mitral regurgitation is now mild, and so less severe than it had been previously. So we talked that we should not be stopping therapies, but I guess what else? So does he need to see you, I guess, at this point would be another question I might ask. So let's say we were heroic primary care doctors and all this stuff on our own. Like when should we actually have this patient see you, and what else should we be thinking about for this patient?
That's a great question. And I do think fewer doctors are better and fewer doctor visits are better. So if I tend to, I love doing GDMT titration. I love doing the telehealth visits every 2 weeks. So if I get to the point where the EF is normalized, like this gentleman's did, or near normalized, 45%, amazing, I will check a second data point 6 months later just to confirm. That's not really in a guideline anymore, but to me, it stands to reason. Let's just get a second data point. And then I tell them, congratulations, you're doing amazing. See me once a year for an echo. Do they need it? Is it fine if they're lost, if they never see me again, but they continue all their meds, will they be okay? Probably. So I would say if you are the heroic internist and you have maximized your GDMT and you've achieved heart failure with improved ejection fraction and you've counseled your patient to stay on all their meds because it's really important and they continue to feel awesome, continue to follow them yourself. The red flags or alarms for which you would want to do something differently is if their clinical status changes. If they start to have new exertional dyspnea symptoms or signs of decompensated heart failure, that's a red flag to say, uh-oh, let's dive deeper. What are we missing? Is there something new going on?
How would you talk to this patient about salt and water intake? Well, we're not talking about hospitalized patients. I know there's been some studies there, but how do you talk to them about salt and water?
You know, I think we've gone away from the draconian 2 grams fluid, 2 grams salt sodium restriction, 2 liter fluid restriction, because as there really isn't strong data to support it, though it's hard to do the data, right? You can't dose humans with salt and fluids like you can dose a lab rat. So again, the studies might not be that earth shattering because the studies are hard to do. So here's my philosophy. Because I have some patients who are on 4 pillars, max tolerated doses, don't even need a diuretic. And sometimes they call me in the heat of summer and say, I'm so dizzy, I can't stand up. I'm like, no, we're not going to reduce your meds yet because you've been tolerating them all winter. We are going to give you some more salt. So I really, to me, it's very individualized. I tell patients, there's no inherent danger to sodium. Sodium is not going to damage your heart. But some people notice that when they eat more salt, they feel worse. They feel puffy. They feel congested. If you are one of those people, avoid salt to improve your quality of life. So that's for that outpatient who's rarely, if ever, admitted on great GDMT. What about the super, super tenuous patient who is in and out of the hospital being evaluated for heart transplant? I say, you are tenuous and you could probably look at a slice of pizza and end up in the hospital because you looked at sodium. So we have to be very careful with you because we have already seen that your fluid balance is so difficult to manage based on your horrible heart and your kidneys aren't great, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it has to be a very individualized approach with the first and foremost recognition that salt is not inherently toxic. It's just for some people, they just can't handle it for their quality of life.
That kind of reminds me of like when sometimes people ask me, can I eat this food or that food? And I say, well, you have a glucose monitor. And if you want to know what it does to your sugar, you can run that experiment. And I guess it's kind of the same thing with salt and water. You know, like your body will tell you if you're overdoing it, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you said like, if everything's going well and, you know, we feel like we're doing okay, they're on GDMT, but who are patients that definitely need to see you?
So I survived medical school through mnemonics, and there is a great mnemonic for who's getting worse. It's the I Need Help mnemonic published by Jay Baumwall in the Journal of Heart Lung Transplant in 2017. Just a little like viewpoint article that is like taken over the world because it's so clinically important. So what is the I Need Help mnemonic? They need IV inotropes, either permanently or transiently to assist diuresis while hospitalized. N, they're NYHA class 3 to 4. They have symptoms with dressing, showering, minimal exertion. E, end organ dysfunction, not doing well with the kidneys or the liver. Other E, ejection fraction. So I don't love this one a lot, but if your ejection fraction is super low, I mean, it's not a great sign. H, hospitalization. Every heart failure hospitalization is a sentinel event. E, they're getting edema despite escalating doses of their diuretics. That's a bad sign, needing more diuretics to maintain. L, their blood pressure is low, their heart rate is high. And P, progressive intolerance of guideline-directed medical therapy. When you start having to peel back on GDMT because of real hypotension, not, oh, my blood pressure is 88 and I feel great, but I feel like I'm going to faint every time I stand up and my blood pressure is 78. That's a hugely concerning sign that they're having progressive symptoms. And I always talk about, as an advanced heart failure specialist, I think about this magical window where the heart is sick enough to need something like a transplant, but the rest of the body is still well enough. And that I Need Help mnemonic is so important to have a heightened awareness of all the horrible things that can happen to a patient, whereby an early referral to an advanced heart failure specialist is important. And I just remembered, I forgot the D. The D was defibrillator shocks. So add that to your list, the I Need Help mnemonic, red flag alert, send to a specialist.
Yeah, probably if a patient's being shocked by their defibrillator, I'm sending them your way.
I have wonderful news. I need a mnemonic if the patient is going through shocks.
All right. What are like two or three take-home points you want the audience to remember from this episode?
So GDMT, the four pillars, the ARNI, the evidence-based beta blocker, the mineralocorticoid antagonist, and the SGLT2 inhibitor. These help patients feel better, stay out of the hospital, live longer, and potentially improve heart function. So for every patient you see with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, ask yourself, why are they not on these four pillars? Can I start them? Can I titrate?
Yeah. All right. And anything you'd like to plug, maybe a book that you've done?
Well, yes, I've written a book. It's called Mastering the Art of Patient Care. It's published by Springer. It's based on the wisdom of my mentors and all the mistakes I have made, so you don't have to make them all yourself. And this is really exciting. Just today, hot off the press, I got an awesome email from a trainee saying, oh my gosh, I read your book. I was in an outside rotation at a really fancy institution, and everyone was so impressed with my presentations because they were so clear and thoughtful. And thank you so much for your book. And I was so happy, because that's why I wrote it.
Fantastic. All right, audience, check that out. Order 5 or 6 copies. You know, do the right thing.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. Please also subscribe, rate, and review the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on YouTube. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Deb Gorth, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto runs our social media. Jen Watto does our Patreon. Krista Chu-Manchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.